Chinese energy sources. The text avoids calls for a phase-out or phase-down of fossil fuels, which have been the focus of deep disagreement among the more than 190 countries meeting in the United Arab Emirates. Instead, the language used is weaker. Countries are called upon to take action that could include reductions in fossil fuels, a conditionality that is far too vague for many countries. The text is expected to form the key outcome of the talks on the future of climate action, and the talks were scheduled to end on Tuesday, 12th of December. The European Union delegation ruled out the document within minutes of it being released, underlining it would walk away from the talks if it was adopted as framed. The Irish Minister for Climate, Eamon Ryan, confirmed the text was unacceptable after coming from an EU delegation meeting. All references to phasing out fossil fuels were excised from a previous iteration and replaced by vague language, he said. Eamon Ryan said the wording of the text will have to be reworked for the deal to be agreed in Dubai. He singled out paragraph 39, which talks about the need to deep, rapid and sustained reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, but with a call to parties to take action that could include a range of measures including phasing down unabated coal and accelerating technologies like carbon capture and carbon storage. In a statement, he said, "We can't accept this text. It's not anywhere near ambitious enough. It's not broad enough. It's not what parties have been calling for." Eamon Ryan added, "If we start with paragraph 39, which goes to the heart of whether we phase out fossil fuel, that one word could just kill everything. We can't have a get-out-of-jail card for the fossil fuel industry, and the current text would give them that." Eamon Ryan added, "We have to hugely strengthen the finance sections. We need to phase up the opportunities to invest in renewable energies, particularly in the developing world. However, above all, we need clear mechanisms for implementation so that we can begin to work on changing the global financial system to incentivize investment in renewable energy systems and in adaptation like water supplies and climate-smart agriculture. These are critical for developing countries. We have to stitch climate justice into every part of this text, and we're not anywhere near that yet." The talks facilitator, Sultan Al-Jaber, insisted in a statement significant progress had been made at COP28. "The COP28 presidency has been clear from the beginning about our ambitions. This text reflects those ambitions and is a huge step forward. Now it is in the hands of the parties who we trust to do what is best for humanity and for the planet." But as ministers and negotiators went into plenary session on Monday night, 11th of December, Sultan Al-Jaber's text, which emerged many hours later than expected, was severely criticised by the climate campaigners, particularly on the basis that it would not align with keeping global warming to within 1.5 degrees Celsius. The chair of the elders, Mary Robinson, said the wording was grossly insufficient. "It is not good enough to say that you recognise and respect the science, but then fail to take heed of its dire warnings in the collective action you commit to. It is not good enough to note, with alarm and serious concern, the findings of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change 6 assessment report and the damage being caused by climate change, but then fail to put in place the steps the science recommends. It is not good enough to say you reaffirm the Paris Climate Agreement, but to then fail to commit to a full fossil fuel phase-out. To use weak language or to permit loopholes for the fossil fuel industry to continue to contribute to the very problem that countries are meant to be committed to tackling here in Dubai." Carol Balfe, the chief executive of ActionAid Ireland, said the previous draft text had broken new ground in proposing a phase-out of fossil fuels. "To take it over the finish line, we just need to agree the finance and fair timelines that would make the package workable for lower-income countries," she said. However, Carol Balfe added, "But instead of taking us closer to a fossil-free future, this draft takes a giant step backwards. It's staggeringly empty of new commitments. Instead of deciding to take action, it simply recognizes the need to phase down unabated coal and scale up renewable energy, leaving out any reference to other fossil fuels such as oil and gas. While it notes the need for finance, Carol Balf said it does not actually provide any. It legitimizes debunked technologies such as carbon capture and carbon storage. It is a paper fan being waved at a burning house. With COP28 scheduled to end in the coming hours, rich countries needed to agree to end their fossil dependence and provide the finance that can swing the deal and promise a safer future for billions of people. The global stocktake conducted at COP28 should be a shared action plan to realize our dream of meeting the Paris Climate Accord. Instead, this text is a nightmare of weak proposals and internal contradictions, asking to keep 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature rise in reach on the one hand, while on the other setting out no common pathway for phasing out fossil fuels. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. The COP28 presidency has released a second proposed text of a climate agreement. A proposed climate agreement released by the president of the COP28 climate summit would for the first time call on nations to transition away from fossil fuels to avert the worst impacts of climate change. The latest draft text, released early on Wednesday, 13th of December, in the United Arab Emirates, did not include a commitment to phase out or phase down fossil fuels, as many countries, civil society groups and scientists had demanded. Instead, it called on countries to contribute to global efforts to transitioning away from fossil fuels in energy systems in a just, orderly and equitable manner, accelerating action in this critical decade so as to achieve net zero carbon emission by 2050, in keeping with the science. The release of the proposed compromise followed a fraught 36 hours of negotiations after the summit president, Sultan Al-Jaber, released a draft report which was roundly rejected by rich and poor countries alike, who described it as grossly insufficient, incoherent, and a death certificate for low-lying and vulnerable nations. The new proposal said countries recognized the need for deep, rapid, and sustained reductions in greenhouse gas emissions in line with 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature rise. It called for a tripling of global renewable energy capacity by 2030 and repeated previously agreed language that they would accelerate efforts towards the phase down of unabated coal power. It also called for the development of zero and low emission technologies, including renewable energies, nuclear energy abatement and removal technologies such as carbon capture and utilization and carbon storage, particularly in hard to abate sectors, and low carbon hydrogen production. Scientists say fossil fuels are by far the largest source of the greenhouse gas emissions driving climate change.
Situated in a relatively remote desert at the Negev Nuclear Research Center, the Dimona reactor is a heavy water-moderated natural uranium-fueled reactor. Most independent analysts believe that in the mid-1970s, Israel upgraded the installation to generate between 70 and 150 megawatts. Now that output makes it not only the region's largest reactor, but the sole evident producer of plutonium and tritium from nuclear weapons. And although Israel neither confirms nor denies its atomic arsenal, Experts believe that it's been a nuclear-armed regime now for several decades. I'm Daniel Arya, and this is Aperture. While the Zionist regime of Israel has maintained its decades-long policy of deliberate ambiguity about its weapons of mass destruction, its deadly arsenal is not the only danger threatening lives. The very existence of the Dimona is a terror haunting Jordan and Israel's other neighboring countries. A higher rate of cancer and the constant fear of possible malfunctions at the reactor are some of the worries that locals must deal with on a daily basis. And the Israelis are aware of the possibility of a meltdown at the Dimona reactor, a meltdown that would affect an area reaching Cyprus and the entire neighboring region. What makes these concerns even more pressing are satellite images of the Dimona reactor. Its walls have cracks which could cut its life by half. Join us this week's documentary exploring the threats that Dimona is posing on its neighbors.
Let's talk about Dimona. Many people say, well, nobody knows.
You see, I blush, you say Dimona and I blush. We're not supposed to talk about Dimona. But
why?
Go ahead. Because it's a taboo. It's a taboo, it's a secret.
Negev Desert, south of Israel. This mysterious complex away from the public eye employs thousands of people, all sworn to secrecy. When its existence was discovered, Israel said it was a textile factory, never admitting its true purpose, making plutonium for atomic bombs. We need answers. And we go to meet one of the few people in Israel that knows what is going on inside Dimona.
We are dealing with this element of weapons of mass destruction, meaning nuclear, chemical, and biological. We're the only NGO dealing with this right now in Israel. When you believe that these are the weapons that keeps you safe, when this is the common belief, then the question raised, are we the next country to use them? Israel is a nuclear armed state, chemical armed state, and biological armed state. Nuclear weapon is not a weapon that aimed at an army. It's a weapon that destroys a city. Are we willing to destroy any city in the Middle East? Mothers, children, fathers, citizens, not soldiers.
Want to know more about the most secretive nuclear program in the world?
Just transmitted at the request of the.
Is the Israeli nuclear plant at Dimona poisoning and threatening the lives of millions throughout the Middle East? From Tel Aviv, we go south. Our destination, Dimona. Approaching the nuclear plant is a high risk. Highway splices through the heat and sand of the Negev Desert. Barbed wire fence edges the road. Signs posted every few hundred meters warn drivers not to stop their vehicles under any circumstances.
They have cameras, they will see.
This is a military zone.
It says don't go off the road. Military zone, no photography.
Finally, we can have a distant look at one of the world's most secret facilities. An exclusive view of a secret Israel is hiding since the 1960s. Dimona Nuclear Plant.
That's the gate. Go
Only a few people in the world can say they know each corner of Dimona nuclear plant. And all of them are sworn to secrecy. But there is someone that knows exactly how the building looks like.
It was a secret competition with the design of the civic center of a new atomic research center that was to be built in Dimona, in the south part of Israel. For security reasons, we couldn't call it a civic center of research, what it was called, a civic center in the Negev. In the 60s, it wasn't such big news to have a textile factory in Dimona. So if you built something large in Dimona, you could very easily say, you see, this is a textile factory. Only that this textile factory had a dome and very... wasn't typical of textile things, but it wasn't seen from the road. It was kind of an agreed quietness. I have the photograph. While the project was being built, not when it was occupied. Then at that time, the security eye was not that strong. So I took the photographs. Later, many years afterwards, I all of a sudden got several photos from an unknown source, but with a stamp of the censorship. So I understood that somebody from the site sent me photos that were taken there. There's a sign that I can open my small portfolio and make it public. The courtyard of the main building, from the other side, looking towards the entrance. The detail of the stairs leading from the to the roof. You can have a roof cover. You can go up to the roof under cover. There's a kind of...
This message is transmitted at the request of the United States
when
Office
President
of
Kennedy
Defense.
Took office, he knew from a CIA secret report that Israel was developing a nuclear program in the Negev. In the beginning of January 1961, Kennedy met the Israeli ambassador in Washington and expressed that the USA wanted to inspect Dimona to be sure about its purposes. Israel accepted, but under one condition, if it was done on a secret basis. For 5 months, the visit of the American inspectors to Dimona nuclear plant was postponed several times by Israel. Finally, an ultimatum from USA was accepted. Two American scientists were allowed to visit Dimona in May 1961. Israel imposed several rules on the American inspectors. They were not allowed to take any pictures or issue any comments about Dimona. When the inspectors finally entered the plant, they were misled. They were shown a fake control room on the ground floor. 12th of January 1961, the aim of the building built in the Negev was clear. In a high-level meeting between President Eisenhower and his staff, the U.S. Secretary of Defense informs the president that based on intelligence findings, Israel was lying and Dimona was not for peaceful purposes. They were unaware of the 6 floors below where the plutonium was made. In search of answers, we travelled to Berlin in Germany. Here we are going to meet Xanthe Hall. She is an expert in nuclear weapons and the director of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Cynthia Hall is also the coordinator of the European Parliament Commission Against Nuclear Proliferation.
The Israel Atomic Energy Commission is one of the most secret institutions in the world. It's responsible for Dimona, its chairman is Netanyahu, but it's not even officially recognized as existing. All the other nuclear plants in the world are monitored by the Atomic Energy Agency, but not the ones in Israel. So we think it's about time that Dimona was also monitored. The one thing that needs to happen is that an independent body like the IAEA would go into Dimona and find out what is going on there, what is the state of the substance of the building, is the containment of the nuclear reactor still intact, what are they doing about cooling, where is the nuclear waste being stored, how is it being stored, and all these questions, they need to be answered. We need some transparency.
Israel has not ratified the non-proliferation treaty, a way of avoiding inspections to its nuclear sites.
First of all, we are not obliged. We are not part of the treaties. We never signed the treaties, so we don't oblige. We never said we won't. That's one thing. Second thing is the US. And the third thing is the Holocaust.
How?
Guilt. Do you see Germany? Germany sold us the submarines. The US, they let us steal uranium. You go to the UN, to the NPT, to the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and you hear the US delegation reading their statements, and when they talk about Israel, you see paragraphs that you know from the language was written by Israelis.
So Israel has a special treatment?
Yes, we're a special case.
Yoshi Melman is known as an investigative journalist, specialized in intelligence and strategic affairs. He was described by WikiLeaks as an information mule who has exchanged tips with the Mossad. But in 2009, Melman uncovered a terrible secret about Dimona. Workers at the nuclear reactor facility were made to volunteer to drink uranium in 1998 as part of an experiment.
The workers themselves already cannot say anything. They have so many contracts saying that they cannot say. The question is the family. So usually in order for them to get compensation, the families also have to say they will not sue, they will not say, they will not speak to the media, and so on. So we know only when they have settlements, when the court say settlement, that they give some money, but we don't know how much usually, and we don't know how many, and we don't know what conditions. And also their doctors are only doctors that work with the commission.
I mean, if you only have a nuclear reactor that is making energy like Chernobyl or Fukushima, that's just one thing. You have lots of possibilities for accidents, but if you've got added to that, you've got uranium enrichment, you've got plutonium reprocessing, and you have actually the making of the warheads, then you have, you know, many more possibilities. Have there already been accidents? There's been some rumors and speculation that in 1966 there was a criticality accident at Dimona. We don't know what's been happening in that plant, and actually it seems that there's probably more secrecy than there was in the Soviet Union, because quite quickly after the Chernobyl accident it was actually said that there had been the accident. So I think Israel is more better to compare on the level of secrecy about a nuclear program with perhaps North Korea, because we know nothing about their program either. We do know that they have one, and at least North Korea is making claims that it has nuclear weapons, whereas Israel is pretending that it doesn't. So I'm not trying to say that there will be worse or better, but there are many more possibilities, so the risk is definitely higher.
Anna our next stop in search of answers about the Israeli nuclear program and its secrets is a Palestinian village. Dahria, very close to Dimona, and a military field where Israel might be burying nuclear waste from Dimona. In Dahria, a Palestinian doctor struggles to keep Dimona's victims alive. Cesium is not present in nature and can only be found in areas where a nuclear disaster or test takes place.
We know how cesium works on the body because of Chernobyl and Fukushima. Both of those accidents showed us a lot of about how cesium actually affects human health, and that there are claims that there has been a study that has found cesium in the region, and cesium is an indication that something has happened with a nuclear activity. It most likely would be, depending on the amount of it, would be from a nuclear accident, or it could be from leaking radioactive waste.
In some areas of Palestine, the presence of cesium is at the same levels as in Chernobyl or Fukushima, places where the worst nuclear accidents took place.
It's a radioactive isotope. It has a half-life of 30.2 years, and it acts like potassium or like salt. It's water soluble, so it can spread very quickly through the body, and it tends to concentrate then in muscle tissue. And you also have muscles in certain organs like heart and stomach and intestines, so that's where often cesium will end up, and at that point it starts then to mutate the cells within those muscles, and you end up with cancer of the colon, cancer of the stomach, of the lungs sometimes, and it can lead to heart disruption.
There are many rumors about where they bury the waste, but my, and not just my, estimations are that all the materials are buried in the area surrounding the reactor, and the reason is that these materials are secret. They don't want people to go and take land samples or go with Geiger.
The Geiger counter is an electronic device that measures the level of radioactivity. These devices are allowed for use everywhere in the world. It is sold everywhere, even online, but not in Israel. Despite claiming to be democratic, Israelis cannot buy a Geiger counter inside Israel.
One of the major problems that we have, again, it goes back to the secrecy problem, is that we can't even measure the amount of radiation in the area, because that's not allowed. And the Israeli law even says that if you take a Geiger counter into the area around Dimona and measure the radioactivity, you could be then sentenced to 15 years in prison. So nobody's going to do that. I know people even thought about doing it, but they didn't. It's certainly very risky to try to do any research on this at all, which is why number one problem is to get rid of the secrecy.
What is the security of Israel, and why the security of Israel is so different than the security of the people that live in Israel? And we hear rumors about buildings where the levels of cancer is unbelievable. And when we wanted to ask doctors, we also didn't get any answers. And one of funny or sad answer we got was that we cannot measure the amount of cancer, radiation-related cancer in Israel, because we had so many people coming from Chernobyl, from Kiev, and that changed the numbers. So that was one answer we got.
And of course, this is not a serious answer. People in Dimona are not rich, most of them. This is, if they were rich people, they wouldn't live next to a reactor, I guess. They wouldn't be depending on this reactor for their livelihood. A few years ago, they all got iodine pills that were very old iodine pills, and that was it. And they're not asking, and that's the problem, that they are more afraid to talk about it than the radiation.
But there are more cases around Palestine. In a small village lost in Al-Khalil Hills, there are other victims. One of them has already died. His son fears the consequences of telling his father's story and only accepts to talk if we protect his identity. This and many other cases come from the same region.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Donald Trump has picked up the endorsement of Texas Governor Greg Abbott during a visit to U.S.-Mexico border. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump on Sunday, 19th of November, received the endorsement of Texas Governor Greg Abbott for his 2024 presidential bid at a campaign event near the U.S.-Mexico border, a region that has played a pivotal role in the political careers of both Republicans. Greg Abbott, another fierce critic of President Joe Biden's immigration policies, gave Donald Trump an effusive endorsement in Edinburgh, a small city in Texas's Rio Grande Valley, one of the busiest sectors for unlawful border crossings, and an area where Republicans have made inroads with its predominantly Hispanic communities in recent years. After serving meals to Texas National Guard members and troopers involved in the state's border security initiative, known as Operation Lone Star, Donald Trump and Greg Abbott embraced each other on stage, set up in front of Texas law enforcement helicopters, a plane, and an armored vehicle. "We need a president who's going to secure the border," Greg Abbott said. In recent weeks, Donald Trump has escalated his harsh rhetoric on immigration and the scope of his promises on the issue, which some of his advisers believe partially catapulted him to victory over the former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in 2016. In one recent interview, Trump claimed that migrants were poisoning the blood of our country. During his presidency, Donald Trump staged a crackdown on illegal and legal immigration, taking unprecedented actions to cut immigrant admissions, restrict access to the asylum system, build hundreds of miles of border wall, and end temporary deportation protections for hundreds of thousands of immigrants, including those who arrived in the United States as children. But Trump has promised to take his hardline immigration agenda further if he's elected in 2024. Pledging to carry out the largest deportation operation in U.S. history, expand his travel bans, deny birthright citizenship to the American-born children of unauthorized immigrants, and reject legal immigrants with political beliefs he disagrees with. Donald Trump has also refused to rule out reviving his infamous migrant family separation policy, which he discontinued in 2018 after a widespread public outcry. Greg Abbott, who has not yet endorsed a presidential candidate, has also made immigration a top issue during his governorship, turning Texas into a chief adversary to Joe Biden's migration and border measures. Since Joe Biden took office, Greg Abbott has ordered state officials to fortify the banks of the Rio Grande with razor wire and river barriers, directed Texas troopers to arrest migrant adults on trespassing charges, and authorized the state to bus tens of thousands of migrants to Democratic-led cities, mainly New York and Chicago. Greg Abbott is also expected to sign what would be the harshest state immigration law in modern American history. The measure, known as SB 4, will empower state law enforcement officials to arrest migrants on new illegal entry criminal charges, and allows state judges to issue deportation orders to suspected violators. After it passed the Texas legislature earlier this month, the bill was denounced as draconian and unconstitutional by the Mexican government, Democratic lawmakers, and the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, which has promised to challenge the measure in courts of law. SB 4 will almost certainly also trigger another legal clash with the Biden administration, as immigration enforcement is a federal responsibility. In recent days, President Biden's re-election campaign has seized on Donald Trump's 2024 immigration promises, casting them as radical and cruel. In a public messaging campaign, it hopes will galvanize Latinos to vote against Trump. Donald Trump has been unapologetically open about the extreme, inhumane, and fundamentally un-American policies that he would enact if he found his way back into the Oval Office. Julie Chavez Rodriguez, President Biden's campaign manager, said at a press briefing, "Joe Biden faces his own political challenges on immigration, one of his worst polling issues. His administration has been under growing pressure from Republicans and many Democrats to limit the entry of migrants along the southern border with Mexico, where migrants' apprehensions have reached record levels over the past 3 years." National broadcaster NBC News has also covered this same story. Donald Trump picked up the Texas governor's endorsement on Sunday, 19th of November, during a visit to U.S.-Mexico border town, and promised that his hardline immigration policies in a second presidential term would make Greg Abbott's job much easier. "You'll be able to focus on other things in Texas," Trump told Abbott, as they each appeared before a crowd of about 150 at an airport hangar in Edinburgh, Texas. Greg Abbott, a longtime ally and fellow border hawk, said he was proud to endorse the former president, who is the Republican Party's front-runner for the 2024 nomination. "We need a president who is going to secure the border," Greg Abbott said, speaking in a town that is about 30 miles from the Hidalgo port of entry, crossing with Mexico. "We need Donald Trump back as our president of the United States of America." Earlier, Trump served meals to Texas National Guard soldiers, troopers, and others who will be stationed at the border over Thanksgiving. Donald Trump and Greg Abbott handed out tacos, and the former president shook hands and posed for pictures. "What you do is incredible, and you want it to be done right," Donald Trump told them. Greg Abbott said about the Guard members and Texas troopers who are stationed at the border, he said, "They should not be here at this time. They should be at home." He said the only reason why they're here is because we have a president who is not securing our border. Donald Trump has been laying out immigration proposals that would mark a dramatic escalation of the approach he used in office, and that drew alarms from civil rights activists and numerous court challengers. Though Trump has peppered campaign speeches with his immigration plans, he only made brief remarks in border country on Sunday. He spoke for only about 10 minutes against the backdrop of state police helicopters, a plane, and an armed patrol boat, all used by Texas at the border. Donald Trump wants to revive and expand his controversial travel ban, which initially targeted 7 Muslim-majority countries. Trump's initial executive order was fought all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which upheld what Trump complained was a watered-down version that included travelers from North Korea and some Venezuelan officials. He also intends to begin new ideological screening for all immigrants, aiming to bar Christian-hating communists and Marxists and dangerous lunatics, haters, bigots and maniacs from entering the United States. "Those who come to join our country must love our country," he has said. Trump would target foreign nationals on college campuses and revoke the student visas of those who express anti-American or anti-Semitic views. He would also invoke the Alien Enemies Act to remove from the United States all known or suspected gang members and drug dealers. The law was used to justify internment camps during the Second World War. It allows the president to unilaterally detain and deport people who are not U.S. citizens. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. Texas Governor Greg Abbott officially endorsed former President Donald Trump for the GOP primary nomination at a Sunday event honoring service members stationed on the Texas-U-Mexico border. "Joe Biden is causing a potential terror threat in the United States of America," Greg Abbott said at the event. He added, "A president has one ultimate responsibility, and that's national security. Joe Biden has failed at national security. Well, I'm here to tell you that there is no way that America can continue under the leadership of Joe Biden as our president." Greg Abbott added, "We need a president who's going to secure the border. We need a president who's going to restore law and order in the United States of America, not letting these criminals run ransack over the stores that you see images of almost nightly. We need a president who's going to restore world peace, as opposed to this outbreak of warfare under Joe Biden. We need Donald Trump back as our president." Greg Abbott, in his speech, also praised Donald Trump's border policies, including Title 42, building a border wall and eliminating the catch-and-release practices that allows immigrants caught in the United States without proper documents to be released from detention while their cases play out in courts of law.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with Iran's sports champions and medalists of the 2023 Asian Games and the Asian Paragames. This meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh on November 22, 2023. I would like to thank these dear young people and these dear teenagers. Your work was truly beautiful. It was very good, and I must truly thank their teachers. Much hard work has been put into this, and the outcome is good. These dear brothers, we used to call them Murshid, guide or leader of Zurhane. Back then, I don't know what they are called nowadays. I would like to also thank these brothers. They led and permitted us in Zurkhane terms. They truly beat the drums well. They did a great job. Overall, the traditional sport moves that were performed here today were very good. Now, I would like to share two or three things with you, dear athletes, both veteran athletes and young athletes. The first point, which I believe may be the main point, is gratitude and appreciation. I truly feel it is my duty to express my gratitude, first of all, to all the athletes and hardworking people in the area of sports. I would like to thank all those who work hard, put in their effort, and endure hardships in the area of sports. Being in the field of sports requires willpower and determination. You have shown this to us. Our athletes have demonstrated this. Praise God.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to thank the medalists in this field. A medal is a sign, a symbol, an indication of your hard work. I am sincerely grateful to the medal winners. I would like to thank our female athletes. I would like to thank the woman who carried the flag in the opening ceremony during this round of the Asian Games while wearing full hijab. She showed the identity and character of an Iranian woman to the entire world. I would like to thank the female athlete who refused to shake hands with a non-mahram man, not from her intimate family, during the awards ceremony. He extended his hand toward her, but she declined to take it. These are very significant things. These things are just as important as sports are, if not more. I would like to thank the woman who went to the podium with her baby. She went on the podium with her baby in her arms and received her medal. This was a symbolic move. In the world, this shows a woman respecting the role of the family and the role of a mother.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime's genocidal war on Gaza has involved continuous attacks on the healthcare system. According to the World Health Organization, 24 out of Gaza's 36 hospitals were damaged between October 7th and December 7th. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more.
We'll be right back.
The Electronic Intifada wrote, "The Zionist regime is not satisfied with killing Palestinians using missiles, bombs, artillery shells, and bullets. It also kills in more insidious ways by denying food, water, and medicine to the people of Gaza. Worse, the Zionist regime deprives Palestinians injured in its violent attacks of the chance of being rescued or dying with the least amount of pain. The genocidal war on Gaza has involved continuous attacks on the healthcare system. According to the World Health Organization, 24 out of Gaza's 36 hospitals were damaged between October 7th and December 7th. Because of the Zionist regime's attacks, more than 50 out of Gaza's 72 primary health facilities are no longer in service. The rest are only functioning partially. The Zionist regime has killed almost 300 Palestinian healthcare workers and abducted more than 40 in that period. The remaining workers have been toiling away for more than 2 months. Not only are they burnt out, they lack food, water, and shelter for themselves and their families." The Zionist regime's destruction leaves an irreparable void in Gaza's health services, which were already overstretched before October 7th. There is a shortage of everything from canals and syringes to imaging devices. Wounded people who could be saved by urgent bleeding control or by the right doses of antibiotics are dying because such services are not available and because it is not possible to access healthcare. The infection of wounds leads to complications and eventually death. Dua Yusuf is a family doctor. She was a co-supervisor during internship at Sabha Al-Harazin Primary Care Center in Shuja'iya neighborhood of Gaza City. Dua said, "The healthcare system is completely shattered. In other words, there is no system." Dua is now working at a primary care center in Rafah, Gaza's southernmost city. Hundreds of thousands of patients are now left without medicines. Paramedics do not even have very simple painkillers such as paracetamol. Before the current war, and with Gaza blockaded since 2007, medications for chronic diseases and infections would start to run out in the last 10 days of each month. Patients needing those drugs would have to wait until the beginning of the following month. Then Gaza's health ministry would provide new supplies. That would often involve borrowing medicines from clinics run by the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA, or buying medicines at high prices from private pharmacies. Now, there is almost no medicine in Gaza. The shelves are bare in governmental and UNRWA clinics and private pharmacies, if those pharmacies are still operating. More than 220,000 people with high blood pressure do not have medicine. Around 71,000 people with diabetes do not have insulin or anti-diabetics. Some 1,100 people who need kidney dialysis face major and potentially life-threatening complications because the healthcare system has been forced to collapse. In Gaza, more than 2,000 people are diagnosed with cancer per year. They include approximately 120 children. The two hospitals specializing in cancer have been attacked. Dua Yusuf said, Our center receives 600 patients per day. We are seeing a huge number of infections. Most of them are respiratory, skin, and gastrointestinal, chickenpox, lice, and scabies, flu, and hepatitis A are extremely common. People in Gaza are living in inhumane conditions. Displaced people do not have adequate shelter or clothing in the harsh winter weather. About 700 people share each bathroom in UNRWA schools. That means adults and children have to queue for hours before they can use a bathroom with scarcely any water. Families have to cook and bake on open fires. Keeping kitchen utensils clean is often impossible. Taking a shower has become a luxury. Vast numbers of people have gone for long weeks without showering. Mountains of garbage can be found all over Gaza. Waste collections are not taking place. It is too dangerous for such services to be provided. Dead bodies are scattered in the streets and under the rubble of buildings. Nobody can access them. Under these circumstances, communicable diseases can spread like wildfire. The primary care center where Dua works has a maternal and newborn section. She said, pregnant women who need special care for high blood pressure and diabetes can't find the right medicine. They use whatever is available and hope that nothing serious will happen. Newborns and their mothers are not able to receive proper care. Or if they do get care, it's not in the appropriate environment. Babies are not getting their vaccinations or examinations they need. Dua said, promoting breastfeeding is extremely difficult and getting formula is impossible as the prices are astronomical. That's if it is available. It is estimated that there are more than 50,000 pregnant women in Gaza at the moment. Mothers who have given birth in hospitals since the war began have been discharged as fast as possible. Many of them are now staying in schools. Everyone in Gaza is mentally scarred by this horrific war by the Zionist regime. They are struggling for the most basic necessities in life. Gaza is reeling under the weight of a humanitarian catastrophe. The need for an immediate ceasefire cannot be overstated. If the war continues, the catastrophe will get much worse.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The world's largest gathering dedicated to refugee issues. After 4 years holding its second meeting, bringing together member states, civil society, financial institutions, private companies, and more than 300 refugee advocates. An important participant, Iran. According to UNHCR data, as of mid-2023, the Islamic Republic has been the largest refugee-hosting country in the world.
There's no temporary solution to the refugee crisis. The UNHCR and the international community have to take serious measures for refugees to be able to go back home. The Islamic Republic of Iran has been hosting refugees for the longest time in history. Over the past 45 years, and even more recently since the developments in Afghanistan in 2021, my country is hosting the largest number of refugees in the world, providing them with health care services and education for their children, despite the fact that we are under harsh U.S. sanctions ourselves.
But while the protracted crises in places like Afghanistan